Welcome to Legend Lore with Luis and Lauren, where we talk about Pathfinder 2nd Edition.
I'm Luis, and I'm a developer at Paizo, working on the Pathfinder Lost Omens lines. I've been playing tabletop RPGs for over 15 years, written for dozens of Pathfinder products, and I also write the Monsters Physique blog here on the No Direction Network.
And I'm Lauren, and I've been playing RPGs for almost 20 years. I write the Bend the Knee blog here on No Direction, and you can also watch me play in the Adventurous, Stellar, Fall of Plaguestone, and Three Ring Adventure podcasts. And this week, we're talking about teamwork.
Before we get started, we just want you to know that although we know a lot about what we're talking about when it comes to Pathfinder, we are not providing any kind of official answers. We're here to offer advice, and you can use that however you like. Remember that the official word from Paizo is the only official ruling out there. But don't forget, it's your game. Do what works best for your table.
When we're talking about teamwork, we're talking about individuals coming together to combine their strengths and make a sum that's greater than their parts. In real life, teamwork's how you accomplish tasks that might be too much for one person to handle. In fantasy, though, that task might be slaying a fire-breathing dragon that's got an entire town held hostage. You might need to be able to mitigate the damage coming from it, deal damage to it, handle situations that arise in combat, and not one class has all of the options needed to slay this mighty beast. But each class, each character, has something they can contribute.
Pathfinder, by design, is not a single-player game. It's not just you versus the monsters. It's you and your allies working against all the challenges that come up. That is intentional. We don't have a class that is the one class that always wins combat or the one class that always solves every diplomatic situation. Everyone has to work together because every class has faults or places where they aren't as strong as other classes, and working together is definitely important and built into the way the game is supposed to work.
Some of my favorite examples of teams from popular culture include the Guardians of the Galaxy, the Winchester Brothers from Supernatural, and near and dear to my heart, the crew of the Starship Enterprise. Obviously, there's Batman and Robin, too. Now, in-game, teamwork in aiding someone, that looks like the tank preventing the flow of damage from moving into your backlines. It might mean healing your fallen warriors before death claims them. It could even mean disarming traps and opening locks. But the kind of teamwork that we're going to focus on today is the kind that gives a bonus to your other party members, either directly or indirectly. We might hit some other topics, but that's going to be what we're really looking at.
Okay, Lauren, how can I help?
Well, 2nd Edition has a handful of things that let you help. We're going to look at some spells. We're going to look at class feats, we're going to look at skill feats, we're going to look at general feats, and we're going to look at the aid reaction. Now, Luis, tell me a little bit about the aid reaction.
Aid. It's one of the basic actions in the game, found on page 470 in the core rulebook. Actually, the very first basic action, I think. It's by chance, you know, alphabetical order that it goes first, but I like to imagine that that's us subtly saying one of the most important things in the game is to help others. Aid is a reaction. The trigger is an ally is about to use an action that requires a skill check or an attack roll. And the requirements are that the ally is willing to accept your aid and you have prepared to help. Basically, to use the aid reaction, you have to plan in advance. You say that on your turn, I want to aid my friend. Let's say we're about to try to break down a door. I want to help the fighter try to break down a door. You say that on your turn, you use an action probably, or maybe even two actions to prepare yourself for that. And when it comes to that ally's turn, then once they attempt the check, let's say an athletics check to bust a door down, it could also be things like a thievery check to disable a trap, things like that. You, as your reaction, attempt skill check that is going on, or if you're trying to help in combat, you attempt the attack roll that is happening, usually versus a DC of 20, but the GM has the option to adjust that DC. If it's something that's super easy, it might be DC 15, DC 10. If it's something hard, it could go anywhere from above a DC 20. If you succeed, you grant a +1 circumstance bonus to that triggering check to your ally. So if you try to help the door down, you grant a +1 athletics, and so on and so forth. If you have a critical success, the ally gains a +2 instead. If you happen to be master with the skill check or the attack roll involved, it's actually a +3 bonus or a +4 bonus if you're legendary. Failing means nothing happens, you didn't help out, but on a critical failure, you actually impose a -1 circumstance penalty because maybe you got in the way or you tripped over your shoes or whatever, trying to bust down the door, and it makes it harder. But that's it. You plan in advance on your turn. As a reaction, you make the skill check, and with a success or a critical success, you grant a bonus to the ally who's trying to actually do the check.
I like how humans can take the heritage feat or the ancestry feat cooperative nature to get a +4 on all of their aid reactions. And I like how the bard gets inspire competence so that you can use perform in place of whatever that actual check is. So you're always able to help in a really good manner. But my question is, since inspire competence only works for skill checks that's specifically mentioned, when you aid to attack, mm-hmm. does your attack roll use the multi-attack penalty?
Are you asking the person who is doing the aid action, do they have the multiple attack penalty?
Yes.
You only have a multiple attack penalty when it's your turn. Anytime you happen to attack outside of your turn, which is usually because of reactions, but you might have free actions and stuff that cause that to happen, you don't have a multiple attack penalty. Regardless of what the situation might be, if it's not your turn, you don't have a multiple attack penalty.
So maybe instead of taking that third attack at -10, you might just help somebody else attack.
Yeah, actually, that's a pretty good use of that third action.
So in addition to using the aid reaction, which is the most obvious use of helping your team, there's also spells, and every spell list has options for this. Some of the notable ones are Guidance for only one action, another good use of that last action. Forbidding Ward, you sustain it each round for one action. Help people not get hit. Bless doesn't take an action to concentrate on, so it's very efficient in the action economy. But you do have to use an action if you want to grow the emanation out. Liberating Command is very helpful for one action because grab happens quite a bit, and that can really save your buddy's bacon. I personally like Magic Weapon a lot at the lower levels because that extra striking bonus is a big deal. Blur is good for tankiness.
Blur for tankiness, yes. And I think any kind of concealment is really great. It turns out a percent chance to miss, at least in my experience as a GM, seems to work in the favor of the players a lot. It just has a lot more, you have a lot more enemies attacking players than you have players attacking enemies, especially with larger groups. So every single attack having a chance to fail and miss is really, really strong. So other spells beyond Blur, like Blindness, Cloak of Colors, Glitter Dust, things like that, are really great spells for granting concealment for the players, either through the blind condition or the dazzled condition.
And let's not forget that proper application of the haste spell will solve any problem that your heroes may face. Heroism makes one of your combatants simply better at whatever they're trying to do. And fly is notable because the only thing worse than a frothing barbarian charging at you is when he's flying too.
Yeah, and the great thing about a lot of the spells is most of them have a status bonus to different abilities. So something like Guidance grants you a status bonus to your check there, which is great because it stacks with the circumstance bonus from Aid Another. There are two different bonus types. That means they work together as opposed to overriding each other. Normally, if you have the same bonus type, you take whatever the higher is of the two. You don't add them together. So it's important to keep an eye out whenever you're trying to help people out what kind of bonus you're adding, because it's there's probably a good chance it might be the same type of bonus, and it doesn't stack up all together like there were, I don't know, 15 different bonus types in first edition. It's only three, so it's easier to keep track of, but it means you don't get to get huge numbers anymore.
Now, in addition to spells and aid and other reaction, every class also has their own brand of helping. Well, almost every class. Let's talk about some of them real quick. The Alchemist, Curudgeon style, hands out healing potions and buff every day. They just wake up, boom, here's some medicine that you hand out.
And it's not just that Alchemist type. I mean, all Alchemists can make elixirs of life and things like that. It just happens to be, if you're a Curudgeon, never know how to say that word, you get a lot of them. You're really good at it, but any Alchemist can do that, even if you're focused more on mutagens and stuff like that.
And that's one of the nice things, I think, about second edition. I'm glad that you mentioned this, is because you can be good at so many different things without just focusing wholly on it. You can be a poison-based alchemist and still just brew up some pretty good healing for your party members without sacrificing on the main thing you're trying to do. Heck, alchemist dedication is a good way to do this too. Now, another class, the Barbarian. This doesn't have as many helping options as, say, some of the other classes, but that's not to mean it can't help. Share Rage is one that I like a lot, because one of your other frontliners could probably really benefit from those temporary hit points and extra damage. On top of that, the Barbarian has a lot of feats for demoralizing, and debuffing your enemies is a good way to support your team. The Bard is probably the class that stands out the most. They have so dang many supporting options that I'd have to do an entire episode on the Bard supporting just to get through them all. And when we get to the Bard episode, we probably won't do it then either, because there's going to be other stuff to talk about with the Bard. But let's see what they can do to help right now. Right out the gate, Bard has Inspire Courage. It's classic. That plus one to hit, always useful. Inspire Defense is soon after that. Inspire Competence, triple time, all before level 6. Bard has so many ways of helping people.
Yeah, and the Bard doesn't run out of these different performances. Most of them are cantrips. Some of them require focus points if you want to make them really good, but the Bard just always has something to help out. Unlike, let's say, someone we're going to speak to in just a second, the cleric, you eventually run out of spells that buff people and things like that. But if you're the bard, you never forget how to sing. You never forget how to dance. You never forget how to give inspiring speeches to help people out. So if you want to just be the person that's helping all the time, bard is probably the best one to go with.
In addition to just being a really good tank, the champion also has some abilities that are really assistive. For example, all of the champion reactions give that ally a resistance to damage, and you can do it just each turn. You're not technically healing somebody with that, but in a way you are, because you're kind of like preventing the damage, you know? Basically healing.
Yeah, they say an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So
there you go.
That's less healing you have to use on your allies later.
And on top of that, champions have Aura of Courage, which is classic and does the trick.
Yeah, and the other thing champions can get if you decide to go into are your mercies, which help clear status ailments, status effects, and conditions off of your allies, which aren't necessarily bonuses that you're giving, but removing negatives are just as good, because negatives can be just as nasty as a buff can be in second edition. Is good for every plus one that you're getting, and a minus one to something like AC or attack rolls can be a huge detriment. So clearing things like the frightened condition and things like that will be godsends, sometimes literally, from the champion to help out the party.
So, as we mentioned, the cleric's mostly just doing some healing, but they're doing pretty well at it. I think if if a character wanted to purely focus on healing, I don't think they can do a better job than the cleric, because the cleric has healing hands, turns all of their D8s on cures to D10s, and all kinds of other healing-focused things.
In addition, they have the Divine Spell list, which has lots of healing and status clear status ailment removal and things like that, buffs and clearing debuffs. And there are some domains that, if you focus on them, will also grant you cool abilities, like the Freedom domain can give you the Word of Freedom domain spell to help liberate your allies here and there. But you have to kind of go out of your way to make sure you're worshiping the right deity and then grab the right domain for what you want to do.
The Druid is another one that doesn't really have that many assistive class feats baked in, but they do have spells, and even primal spells are very good at assisting.
Yep, and if you happen to focus on this, you can summon animals to take up the battlefield to, you know, soak up damage for people or serve to flank and things like that. Or you can have an animal companion that does the same to help out in terms of battlefield positioning and tactics.
The fighter surprisingly has some pretty good things that aid other characters. They're pretty good at most of the athletics combat options. So your trips, your shoves, all that the fighter's going to be pretty decent at. Now, you're not technically tripping and shoving your teammates to help them out, but you're debuffing the opponent with those things, which, you know, in turn, is kind of a buff for your party members. You've also got shield block, which you can hand to your party members. Oh, I see that you're taking some damage here. Boom, I shield block it.
And there's one other thing that every fighter has that some other classes can get, but the fighter always has, which is the attack of opportunity. Which, if an enemy spellcaster is trying to do stuff to harm your team, maybe a well-placed attack of opportunity can stop that spell from happening, or it can bring down an enemy who's trying to close in on your allies and things like that. Attack of opportunity, even just knowing that it's there, can be a scary thing that in it be a strong deterrent for the enemies out there.
Now, Luis, I need your help with this next one. I looked and I looked and I looked, and I found, much to my surprise, that there is nothing helpful about the monk. They do what they do.
I understand what you're saying. There's no feats that are determined, that are specifically for, hey, use this to help someone out. And I mean, I looked through and I didn't see that. I mean,
maybe
much
Stunning
either.
Fist? Maybe?
Stunning Fist can some. But. Yeah, I don't see much. And that doesn't mean monks can't help. There's just any built-in class features or class feats that say, use this to help someone. You're going to have to think outside of your class feats to figure out other ways to help, I think.
You can be a human monk with cooperative nature, you know?
Yeah, or there might be stuff down the line for the monk that gives more options. But at least looking through the core rulebook, monk is really all about perfecting themselves, which is great, but doesn't give you too much to help others in the process.
What I like about the Ranger is how when you just read through the class feats and the abilities, it doesn't automatically look super helpful. But then you look at Monster Hunter, one that people normally would sleep on. Knowledge is power, Luis. And Monster Hunter and the following feat tree helps you know a monster's weakness, which is really a big deal indirectly to your party members.
Yeah, knowledge is in fact power. Knowing that something is weak to a certain damage type or resistant to a certain damage type can help out a lot. Even just knowing, hey, that owlbear, it's got the potential to screech and make us all really scared, so be prepared for that, might mean that the cleric can know, hey, using something like the remove fear spell is going to be helpful right now. So things, just knowing in advance what to expect can do wonders in Pathfinder.
Speaking of knowing in advance, Rangers also can take Scout's Warning so that you give the whole party a buff to initiative. You can take Warden's Boon to grant your edge to, say, the fighter or the barbarian so they can deal more damage in whatever specific way you deal more damage to.
Yeah, Ranger is kind of a surprisingly guidance-focused kind of class, if you want to go that way. It's about, hey, I'm here to lead you and tell you what to do and help you out, and you're all going to be better for it.
You're a Sherpa.
Yes.
Ranger's just the Sherpa.
Definitely.
Rogues also get a lot of things that aid the team. Or baked in anyway. Like, in addition to the obvious, like, finding and disarming traps, rogues also can, just built into the class, take some spells with some of their class feats. They also have a lot of debuff abilities. Battle assessment works a lot like Monster Hunter did for the Ranger, where you use battle assessment and you learn some weaknesses or some strengths of the monster you're fighting.
Yeah, and some of those debuffs can be pretty game-changing. With a rogue, you might apply the enfeebled condition, which makes it harder for someone to hit you, or they at least hit for less damage. You can slow down enemies so they can't get to the back lines as easily. There's a lot of debuffs in the form of the debilitations that the rogue has, so depending on which racket you're going with, you're going to have lots of cool stuff to work with.
Sorcerer has a lot of bloodline powers that give you a supportive boost when you cast your bloodline spells, and that means there's no reason you can't do that with cantrips. And on top of that, since cantrips level up with you, those bloodline boosts are going to continue to level up as well. And you also have access to whichever spell list you want. Wizards, I don't feel like they have a lot of built-in options other than the fact that they have the arcane spell list, and that has haste and some of the nice things like that. But you do have some of the specialists, like abjurers, which have a protective boost that they can put on their allies. You have transmuters, which can put a physical boost on their allies.
Anyone who can cast spells probably has something good going on, but in terms of built-in options, I think that's about it as well for wizards. But as we were saying earlier with the monk, there are still ways to help if it isn't built into your class, because there's a lot you can do in Pathfinder beyond just what your class can give you. And that's what skills come into play for, and specifically skill feats. There are two real big skills, I think, that really help out, at least mid-combat when you're looking for as many boosts and bonuses as you can. The first one is athletics. As we mentioned earlier in the fighter section, athletics is really good for moving people around or just controlling the battlefield in some way or another. Athletics is how you grapple someone. It's how you trip someone. It's how you disarm someone. And all of those are very, very potent. I have a druid player in my Runes of Aslan game who, I mean, he's a druid, he does all the cool druid stuff, happens to be very magical, but still focused on athletics, and every once in a while he will grapple the big boss enemy, and it just is huge for combat. It helps the rogue out, it helps the fighter out, it's just helpful. Grabbing someone means that they become flat-footed. Tripping someone means they become flat-footed, and then they have to spend an action to stand up, which can provoke attacks of opportunity, or at the very least uses up some of their action economy. Trying to break free of a grapple uses up some action economy. Disarming someone, if you critically succeed, they lose their weapons, and a lot of enemies that you fight usually only have one weapon on hand, so that suddenly makes it a lot harder for them to kill the party if they don't have anything in hand.
I fooled around a lot. Well, let me rephrase that. I tried to fool around a lot with athletics in combat with some of the characters that I've had before, and I just couldn't figure it out. As a barbarian, I want to be swinging my axe to deal a lot of damage, and then I've got a last action. Well, I don't want to take a minus 10 attack. Maybe I'll push. But in that situation, you're going to have the minus 10 attack penalty. But then I learned from Vanessa, assurance doesn't use modifiers or penalties. So you can use your assurance athletics and just take your 10, to try and get that shove out.
Yeah, if you're facing a really big, tough guy, use Assurance to trip them, because their reflex save is probably low. If you're facing a big, agile guy, use your Assurance to shove them, because their fortitude save is probably low. Yes, Assurance is a great third action that you can use your athletics with, and it just, if you're a strength-based class focusing on your athletics, you have a pretty good chance of succeeding most of the time with your Assurance on athletics. You probably won't get a crit, so you won't get the cool stuff like disarming someone automatically, things like that, but it's gonna be just a great use of that third action, so you don't have to worry at all about that minus 10 penalty like you were saying.
And if your big tough guy is somebody who's got a low will save, then you always have the option to demoralize with your last action.
Demoralize, one of the other really great actions in combat. Within 30 feet, you attempt a demoralize check to get someone within 30 feet of you. You yell at them, you growl at them, whatever. You make a knife, put your thumb against their neck kind of action to freak them out. You make an intimidate check, and it's against their will DC, as you were suggesting there. On a success, they become frightened. And on a critical success, they become frightened too. And frightened is a huge debuff in this game because it applies to all checks and DCs. What that means is anytime you make a check of any kind, attack roll, a skill check, saving throw, they get a minus to that. Or if it's a DC, like AC is technically a DC, that goes down as well.
What's their AC DC? But don't. Sorry. Now, even if you don't take any of the skill feats to help aid, if your class just really doesn't have any aiding options that you like, if you don't have spells, you still have options to help. For example, you could flank with your rogue. That way they get their sneak attack bonus.
Yep. Or if you are a frontline fighter and you're in a narrow corridor blocking the doorway so other people can get through, or at least make it very difficult for a lot of people to get through at once, can be a huge boon. Just positioning is just very important, especially in cramped quarters.
Now, this is a lot of different ways to help. So what we've done is we have put together two builds in which we will talk about different ways, say, like, one character might look as a supportive character. I have built today, you know, before I start with this build, I just want to say what I like about preparing for Legend Lore is that I make a build that I normally would have slept on, and then I wake because it is so cool. I kind of discover these fun new ideas, and this is yet again one that I'm really excited to play one day. Her name is Ada Helpington. She is an elf who has been operating a shop in town for over 300 years. It's an old shop. It's well known in the area. Ada's peculiar playthings and piquant potions. She adores seeing people smile, especially children. So her store sells magical toys and magical candies that she makes herself. She is going to be a bard, and as a bard, her performance is winding up one of the music boxes that she built herself, which has in it a song that she wrote and composed herself. So, as an ancient elf, she'll be able to take Alchemist Dedication at level 1, and that combined with Expert Alchemy at level 8 lets her craft all manner of healing and other types of just really useful potions each day that she can just hand out to the party. She's also going to have Quick Crafting, Magical Crafting, and Inventor, so she can make or repair really whatever it is that the party needs for the next mission. As a bard, she'll have Inspire Courage, Inspire Defense, and Harmonize, so that she can give the party a +1 to hit, AC, and saving throws. On top of that, she'll also be giving them resistance to damage. As a bard, we're also going to take Inspire Heroics so that one of those inspirations we just talked about might have a chance to be plus 2 or plus 3 instead. Additionally, 8 is going to have some feats for finding and disarming traps, because every party needs that, and some feats for initiative, so that she can hopefully go before the party members, or at least go before the monsters, and get those buffs up as quick as we can. Finally, bards do get spells, and there's an awful lot of powerfully supportive spells in there as well. For example, taking Soothe as a signature spell lets her always have a magical healing option on hand for the party. And bards can take haste, so haste is never the wrong decision. But she is going to shy away from the spells that you need to spend an action on to sustain, because she has so many bardic cantrips that she can be using for boosts that having to sustain each turn is really going to kind of slow down her ability to support.
I went a different route. Magic is cool, but not everyone knows how to use magic or can use magic, so I chose to build something that isn't at all focused on magic, and actually it's something I'm kind of playing right now in a different campaign. I'm going to make the helpful fighter, because fighters are obviously the first class you think of when you think of aid. It turns out there's a lot you can do to help people out that is kind of combat focused. It, you know, might be part of your dealing damage and stuff, but it happens to help out a lot of people. I'm playing a shield and flail, I guess, sword and board style, fighter in the Strange Aeons campaign that Jason Keeley's running for the people at the office here. And I'm playing my fighter, who is actually a fighter I played in the 2E playtest, Solvig Bloodfang. And she is an Ulfin, like, shield maiden style character. And a lot of what I'm going to be talking about here is kind of the way I play her. It's not going to be exactly the same. I'm going to focus a bit more on how she works for aiding. But she is a human. And with being a human, as we mentioned earlier, you have the access to cooperative nature. Cooperative nature says you gain a plus 4 circumstance bonus on checks to aid people. Great. Whenever you want to try to aid, you get a plus 4. So it's going to be easier to just aid right out the gate and maybe even get critical successes.
And that includes attack rolls.
That includes attack rolls. Yes. So then at 5th level as an ancestry feat, she is going to take Clever Improviser, which says you gain the Untrained Improvisation general feat. What that general feat does is, hey, anything that you're not trained in, you still add half your level to it, so as if you were kind of quasi-trained. Once you hit 7th level, though, you add your full level bonus to that. So you're, in a way, kind of trained in everything at that point. You don't get the extra plus 2 bonus from training. Additionally, though, Clever Improviser says, on top of that Untrained Improvisation general feat, any check that requires you to be trained, you can do that, though, even if you're untrained at this point. So you've effectively become trained in every skill in the game at that point. That means you can aid with anything. You can aid on any single skill check that needs to happen in the game. And because you're very cooperative, you get a plus 4 on that. So you may not be trained, but you're effectively an expert on that, because of that plus 4 bonus. And finally, 9th level ancestry feat, I'm going to take Cooperative Soul, which you need cooperative nature to have. And that says if you're at least an expert in the skill you're aiding, you automatically get a success on that, unless you happen to roll a critical success on the check. Basically, you only have two different results that you can get when you try to aid someone if you're at least an expert on it, which is you roll so poorly that you get a success, you roll kind of poorly and get a success, you succeed and get a success, or you critically succeed and get a critical success. So you're going to be helping out no matter what happens. If you're attempting a skill check to aid a skill check in which you're an expert, you roll only really to see if you happen to get a crit. Otherwise, you help out with so much stuff there. And this is something that can apply to any human. So, you know, that if you want to be a human that is also a bard and aiding a lot, this is also a great way to do that, stuff like that. But moving on to the fighter, Solvig is focused on her shield, and so will this fighter be. I'm kind of the mindset that maybe you're just fighting with a shield and an empty hand, because you got to use that hand to help people out. And you could potentially do that. You could get shield boss or shield spikes on your shield and use those to improve your shield bash damage and stuff like that. So if you want to still be doing good damage, you can go that way. But having an empty hand is really, really helpful for aiding stuff.
Captain America style.
Captain America style, yes, exactly. First level, there's a lot of cool stuff you can take. I like sudden charge, but because we're focusing on aiding, snagging strike is probably the way to go. You make a strike and keep one hand free. That's that hand that you don't have anything with. If you hit, the target becomes flat-footed or until they step out of reach of your hand. You kind of basically kind of have them by the scruff of the collar, and have them in a way where it's harder for them to attack. At second level, something like brutish shove or aggressive block will help you push people around. Pushing people around is helpful with positioning, and with brutish shove in particular and aggressive block, you make someone flat-footed if you successfully push them around. Brutish shove is more active. You can do that on your turn. Aggressive block is a reaction. When you shield block, you can add that rider. Alternatively, you can go with combat grab to actually grab people instead of just doing the snagging strike thing. If they're grabbed, then it's even harder for them to get away, making it easier for your allies to come and beat them up. At fourth level, if you happen to focus on brutish shove, you can go with powerful shove, so you can shove even bigger people or do so with your aggressive block as well. Alternatively, knockdown is good. Hitting someone and then getting a chance to trip them is all part of one action that doesn't increase all of your multiple attack penalties at once. Means you have a really good chance of knocking someone down. Again, making battlefield control really helpful there. At sixth level, you could go with Guardian's Deflection to improve someone's AC in a spot where they're just about to be hit. You can prevent a critical success or even an attack from outright hitting them. Alternatively, the big thing to do with shield is to take Shield Warden to use your shield block reaction for your allies, defend them from damage, and you know, that's always really helpful. As we said earlier, mitigation of damage is really, really good. Eighth level lets you take quick shield block, which lets you do more shield blocks on your turn, which is very good with Shield Warden, so you can block twice for your allies, or once for yourself and once for an ally, twice for yourself. And finally, at 10th level, there's a few different things you can take here. Improved knockdown will help you just knock people down a lot easier. Combat reflexes means more attacks of opportunity to slow people down or take them out. And disruptive stance is also really good at stopping spellcasters. Really, it's up to you, but the big thing is using your shield to defend others and using your caring, kind, cooperative nature to help out literally every chance you get.
With all the shield blocks in that build, I feel like you're going to have a smorgasbord of some more boards.
Yes, absolutely.
So, those are some of the ways in which you can help your teammates, but let's talk about some of the ways in which we can help you. Let's answer some questions. From user Zabeev, what are some decent ways to help out your party's rogue by inflicting the flat-footed condition to your enemies? For example, the way alchemists hit enemies with bottled lightning.
One of the easiest things is to flank. Get up behind the enemy and then let your rogue get on the other side of the enemy, and they are flanked, and that counts as being flat-footed for anyone who's involved in that flank. Easiest. I mean, it's the classic thing to do. Just positioning for your rogue is very important. Another thing you can do, which requires some work with the rogue, is there is the rogue feat. Forgot what it's called, so I'm looking it up right now. It's a rogue feat that basically says anytime someone has the frightened condition, you also count them as having the flat-footed condition. So if you are someone who is going to be demoralizing a lot, maybe taking that feat will help the rogue out, and you don't have to worry so much about positioning anymore because, oh hey, the barbarian keeps yelling and scaring everyone. That makes it easy for me to use my Dreadstriker feat to get sneak attacks.
There's also a surprisingly large amount of poisons that apply flat-footed to a target in addition to poison damage and other negative effects. So an alchemist with the bow is going to have an easy time making those poisons and delivering them to the target. If you put a grievous rune on a sword, that sword gains a flat-footed critical specialization effect. So that's pretty good for fighters who crit all the time. Primal and arcane casters can take the level 1 shockwave spell, make creatures flat-footed in a 15-foot cone. Barbarians have shattered defenses, so you just grab someone by their shoulders and push their feet flat. And then keep in mind that anytime you apply the prone condition to someone, they have the flat-footed condition as well. So things like tripping or using a whip feather token or the cleric's feet cast down or even just a wolf animal companion would also help to get that flat-footed condition on more enemies.
Mm-hmm. And the grapple condition, as we mentioned earlier, also imposes the flat-footed condition. So grabbing someone or knocking them down, great options, which the fighter probably loves to do. So, next question from user UpB, who asks, how do you divide out party responsibility to ensure that no one character is stuck doing their one single thing? For example, having the cleric always being the healer, and the fighter always doing the damage, and the bard always doing the buffing.
This was one complaint that I had about just almost all tabletop RPGs for years and years and years. I hated that somebody had to be the cleric so we'd have a healer. And one of my favorite things about 2E is that that's no longer the case. Between all of the different class, skill, general, and heritage feats you get, it's really easy to do the thing that you want to do, but also be good at something that the party needs. For example, if you make a fighter, you're always going to be good at sustained damage, pretty much no matter what you do with your build. But you can also invest all of your skill feats into medicine to be a really good healer as well. But so as long as the fighter is capable of healing in that way, it gives the cleric some breathing room so they can cast offensive spells or wade into melee more often to be that war priest that people like. Characters also being able to be good at more things in this edition allows other characters to focus on things they wouldn't have had time to do in the previous edition. So to ensure that no one is stuck doing the one thing, I'd really just encourage you to let your players know during character creation they should probably be thinking about the different roles that they can take on in addition to the main role that they're trying to take on. Make sure at least like two or three of them have some way to heal. Two or three of them have some way to do good DPS, etc., etc.
Yeah, first edition, I remember a lot of parties getting together and always between the players, it's like, okay, which one of us can detect magic and identify magic items? Which one of us can disable traps and blah, blah, blah? So it's always like one person has to be able to at least cover that one role. And like you're saying, skill feats and ancestry feats and everything make it so much easier for everyone to do that. The fighter with medicine is something I do myself. Solvig, who I base my build off of, is wholly focused on medicine, and she can help you mid combat with battle medicine or after combat between encounters with treating wounds and stuff like that. And it's just as good as anyone else, I'd say, even compared to the cleric in the party. It just so happens to be the cleric has spells that do a lot more healing, and it's great, but you know, helping the cleric out is really good.
And clerics can run out of spells.
Clerics can definitely run out of spells, but you can never run out of bandages, I guess it turns out. Another thing to consider is you don't need magic for some of the skill uses anymore. If you think something is magical, you don't need to be able to detect magic to identify that. If you're trained in nature or trained in occultism or trained in religion, those all count for identifying magic items, even if you just happen to be the fighter who is, or you happen to be the ranger who knows about getting around in the woods because of your nature skill. Oh yeah, but I know what that thing is. It turns out it's magical. You know, lots of little things that used to be kind of locked off behind magic or training are a lot easier for so many class members to get at this point. And if you want to focus on them, you can. You have the skill feats to and the skill increases to focus on it. By the end of your career, you're probably going to be legendary in at least two or three of your skills, and they don't all have to be focused on combat or the one thing that you do.
From patron Jaina B, what are some simple, on-the-fly teamwork combos you can use when you're playing with unknown party members, such as in a Pathfinder Society scenario?
Pretty much all the skill stuff we talked about, I think. Athletics and intimidation, positioning is really good. There are also certain spells that apply kind of across the board. We mentioned heroism being a really, really good buffing spell for that. Things like blur to defend people who need to be defended. Any of the basics kind of work all the time. So if you prep the basic spells, haste, you know, heroism, blur, invisibility, things like that, that's going to help out. And if you use smart tactics, it's always going to be helpful. Our next question is from our patron Nicole. How do you encourage your teammates to play more cooperatively when they don't seem to be, while not being abrasive about it?
So, I've got two things I'm thinking about with this. On one hand, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't force it to drink, you know? And if a player just insists on playing like they are the I in team, they're probably not going to get with the picture. But that's not to say that you can't try to influence their behavior or the behavior of some of your more agreeable players. Now, try this. Consider finding ways to reward your players for cooperative gameplay outside of the fact that they won combat and got that loot. Maybe grant hero points. What I like about this is that granting hero points and finding ways to grant hero points encourages their use. And they're fun, but we tend to just sit on them because we know that if you start dying, you'll need to use it to stop dying. So ways to get more hero points out, this is a win-win scenario. Maybe give them, like, I don't know, I liked the way you went out of your way to help this character. Have 10 experience points. Just some inconsequential number that could add up. Or, this is one that I think is really fun. If two particular characters are kind of aiding each other more, maybe give that character duo a bonus when they cooperate to kind of represent the relationship that they have been nurturing. Well, what it boils down to is you just have to find ways to make it more attractive to cooperate with each other rather than act like a lone wolf all the time.
Another thing you can do if you are the player rather than the GM is maybe set up the people who aren't being teammates just yet and condition them into realizing that that's a good thing to do. If you have a rogue who wants to go out of their way and just sneak around and try to get their sneak attacks on their own, you can be like, hey, I've moved here. If you move over to that spot on the battlefield, we're going to be flanking and you can sneak attack all the time. Or I've, you know, cast fear on this person or whatever the case might be. You do your part and remind the not so cooperative player that you can take advantage of this and do the cool stuff that you're wanting to do and keep trying to do even better, and condition them to the point where once you forget to do that flank or maybe don't cast that fear spell on that combat, they're going to be like, hey, can I get that fear? Can you move over here to help me out? And realize, you know, that you've now trained them to want that teamwork to happen, and they have become a willing teammate at that point because they don't want to miss out on the cool stuff that they were doing thanks to your help.
In other words, what you're saying is subject them to classical conditioning techniques.
Indeed.
Our last question is from user Academic Chris. When does Aid Another really come online? At first level, it seems like it hinders more than it helps, so it tends to be better to demoralize even if you are untrained instead.
Yeah, that is a thing about Aid. If the DC sticks to 20 forever, if your GM never adjusts that, then it will be kind of difficult at early levels. If you're a cooperative human, it might be a little easier, but you're still looking at something like level 3 before that becomes a regular occurrence for a successful aid. So if you're wanting to aid early on, it might be worth asking your GM, hey, would this be an easier thing? Because it's pretty easy to hit, I don't know, the ooze that we're fighting in the first level dungeon, or this rock wall that we climb is normally like a DC 15 to climb, why would it be a DC 20 to aid someone? Things like that. So working with your GM might help ease the pain of low level aid, but really it's gonna be still a little while before aid becomes a competitive option in what you're doing.
I feel like you at least want your aid to be at +8 before you really start doing it, because I like to have the math stacked in my favor, and I like that at +8 you only have a 1 in 20 chance to critically fail. So we've helped you help other people in your party, but now it's time for us to ask for your help. Make sure you check out the rest of the great content on the No Direction Network, because if you like this show or any of the other content that we put out, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/nodirection.
Until next time, I'm Luis.
And I'm Lauren.
Thanks for listening to Legend Lore. And as always, it's been legendary.